This is North Dakota Legislative Review. I'm Dave Thompson. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest this week is the new House Minority Leader, Representative Kenton Onstad from Partial North Dakota. Representative Onstad, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for the invite.
You're a new leader in terms of being the minority leader, but you've been around leadership for a while.
Correct. I used to be the assistant leadership when Merle O'Shea was minority leader. I was involved in leadership last session, and I am now the leader this session in 2013.
What are your challenges being a minority leader in this session?
One of the things is the challenge is, number one, we have a lot of new freshmen. And so it's quickly to get them on speed and be effective and be part of the caucus and be part of their committees and develop themselves that way. Part of it is then working with each of those to work to pass good legislation, help them through that process. And then mainly the last thing is you have strategy throughout the session, bills that you feel we need to support, bills that go to the wayside. And we have our priorities as well that we like to see come out of here, so we can call it a successful session.
So have the priorities changed at all for you since the session began?
Not really. The priorities that we've had, you know, whether it deals with property tax, school funding, funding Western North Dakota, you know, there are higher ed, K-12 education, you know, they still stay the same. It kind of changes as maybe we don't have the same level of priority or how much response, you know, where do you deal with property tax relief? Those venues change.
One issue that seems to be emerging, and the Senate Majority Leader said that last week on this program, is water, especially in the West.
You're correct on that. It seems to be the next phase of that. And before I recognize, you know, I come from a rural community, and a lot of those community members have always been looking for rural water systems. So I've always been supportive of the rural water systems. Now we've gotten into a point where a lot of communities are expanding, and those rural water districts are there, and they would like to expand. And so there seems to be a conflict between urban issues and rural, and we never like to see that. It resembles some of our earlier days with the rural electrics and the IOUs, and can we become willing buyers, willing sellers? Can we work together? And if we can create the policy so we all can work together, that would be the best thing we can do on the state. But clean water, clean air, clean water is still going to be the next revolution between states along with in states.
Now, there was once said by some sage that the difference between whiskey and water is that whiskey is for drinking, water for fighting about, and you're already hearing some back channel talk about some clashes,
right,
between some rural water systems, the WAS project, etc. So where do you see that maybe kind of starting to shake out?
Well, we're really supportive of the WAS and in the process to be able to work this out and get water to a lot of rural communities. The unique part of it was in an area that probably has industrial sales, and that would help pay for it. So that became very unique. A lot of the conflict comes in, other people look as, don't restrict myself from having the ability to sell water as well, because I live on a good aquifer, I have that ability, it's in an area where water is needed. And so that really becomes the issue. Are we restricting competitive nature in the water business?
Don't want to put too fine a point on water, but then you have the downstream interests on the Missouri who are going to fight some of these things, some of the plans to divert some of the Missouri River water to the Western Area Water Supply Project, to the Northwest Area Water Supply Project, maybe to an enhanced Southwest pipeline project. So there's an awful lot that's on the state's plate right now.
A lot of the complaints from Missouri and so on, and their 60 days of barge days and so on, we never really created enough benefits for the Missouri River water. early on, we were always that argument. All we were dealing with was recreation, fishing, the water just went down below. Until recently, with changes in regulations for water quality, people have looked more to the Missouri River to get that water quality, and I think that's been a real plus. The more beneficial uses we can use of the Missouri River to help all these entities is good for the state. And to say that, are we ever going to heart of that water go away, or are we going to demand too much uses of it? There was a time before a lot of this started, if you added up all the day's use, it was about 17 days out of the year. So there's plenty of room to expand that, even to supply the water to the Fargo region. We probably evaporate more in a day than what they would require. And so when you look at those kind of numbers, I think there's a lot of water that can be used. And I encourage us to use that river water, create those beneficial uses, not only for drinking, but also for irrigation, for industrial sales. Water is really important.
Now, one other thing that you had as one of your caucus positions, and I believe you're maybe the lead author on the bill, was to have more money stay with the counties that are impacted by oil development, oil drilling. What's the status of that?
Well, it's still sitting in committee. It hasn't came out of committee at that point. And you're correct. Because I'm from the West, and I see where those communities are struggling in areas, we do have a formula in place that's address impacts for the cities and all the political subdivisions. Has it been enough? We've always restricted that over the years, feeling that was adequate at this point. You know, we're in an unprecedented growth. This isn't taking 20 years for a town to go from 600 to 5,000. In little of 3 to 5 years. So you imagine yourself in that kind of situation. Imagine yourself all of a sudden, we're not talking 5 oil wells in a township, we're talking 36 wells, one on every section. And when you look at the amount of traffic to bring in that well and so on, 1,400 trucks loaded in, loaded out, the daily trucks. Our roads are never designed for that. Our highways were never designed for that, and so it's like we have to rebuild the whole system. I work for a rural electric in my real life, and the amount of connections that's happened at that point, we would hook up 5, 10 miles of new line, and now you're looking at 300 miles. Every well is equivalent to about 15 homes, and so the requirements on the electrical, the requirements on the roads, the requirements on law enforcement, our ambulance services, our emergency services, our schools, our cities, their sewer systems are not large enough. The topics just go on and on. So I'm saying that what we've done in the past does not address that. And we have to address the impact that's happening. Because everybody agrees that what's happening on West North Dakota has been good for all the state of North Dakota. And we want to surround our arms around that and embrace it. But we need to nurture this, what's happening. And so we have to be a little bit more responsible as a state, because the state's got a responsibility to address that. And so we look at additional funding to come back to Western North Dakota. And if you compare us to other states, a lot of the states, when the dollars that come back, 30-40% of the money comes back to those political subdivisions. We are averaging around 11% as a state that comes back to that. So are we adequately addressing that? No, we're kind of maintaining status quo. And we do need to influx more money into Western North Dakota some way, somehow, help these communities out. It's unprecedented. I've said that before, and it isn't just roads that get impacted. The whole gambit gets impacted. We also compete with salary increases. The typical oil industry and so on, they've always held a good salary. And so that opportunity exists for people. So they leave a lower paying job and go into that. So they leave a business that can't afford to match that. So that becomes another endeavor. And then you get the other thing is with housing. You know, we have a lot of apartments going up. We have a lot of motels going up, but they're not cheap. And it's created a problem for a lot of people. They're seeing their rent. And so on one hand, you can't say, well, you know, I can't, you have an opportunity to raise the rent and do that. And so they do. And yet here's people that are probably on fixed income. They don't garner those wages and their rent goes up accordingly. And so some have left. Some have left to other areas of the state. And I really feel too bad about that because they've lived there their whole life. They didn't cause the problem, you know, and yet they see no benefits of what's happened to them. So, you know, we have some wonderful opportunities. You know, we can go back what it was looking like about 10 years ago and all the news articles around Burke Divide and losing 25% of their population. And what are we going to do? This is going to be the Buffalo Commons. And so now here we are, we've seen an influx of people, a lot of people. We need to embrace it. This is our opportunity to set the stage for many, many years for Western North Dakota. We want to do it responsibly. We want to still conserve some of the heritage that we've had before, hunting, fishing, all that people have loved to do. And it's kind of taken a back seat at this point. And yet you still want to return it that way. And then when it's all said and done and gone away, you know, did we leave the land as well as we found it? You know, and that starts a whole nother discussion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, there's plenty of work to do out there. There's plenty of work to do as policymakers to create some things. And we've just stressed the whole system. Courts, they're stressed. Everything's been stressed.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about Senator Cook's bill to change the stripper well exemptions and then eventually in 2017 cut the tax rate, the effective tax rate, from 11.5% to 9.5% on oil. And when he came out with it, let's just say that you weren't really fond of the idea.
I wasn't fond of the idea because, number one, if you really want to fix the stripper tax, you got to recertify every year. They make an attempt to do that, and I'm appreciative of that. They deal with the properties and change it to wells. And the wells stand alone by themselves. And you have to understand when you reach stripper status, okay, that means your production, your wells have gotten to a level that a lot of companies will say, well, it's no longer profitable for me to keep pumping that. So it's maybe a smaller company will pick that up. And it's been good at that point because that smaller company still hired a few people in town and we could always achieve that. Of course, like any industry, the technology improves. So you come back, new tertiary efforts, whether it's horizontal drilling or vertical drilling, there's water flooding, there's CO2 gas that comes in there. New techniques to go back and drill that well out again. And all those things, they improve that production again. Of course, if you're in a stripper status, you don't pay any extraction tax. So now we have wells that have proved and they're no longer in that stripper category where they wouldn't qualify today that way, but yet they remain that way. So if you're really going to fix the stripper problem, you have to go through a recertification annually. And we're the only state in the union that does not have any kind of recertification property of those low producing wells. Once they've improved themselves, let's give them a little time that way, but I think they should go back on the payroll, I guess.
Do you think that because we don't have a certification for stripper wells, do you think that's part of the paranoia or fear that the oil industry may say, oh, we're going to pull out of North Dakota and find another shale play?
No, that's That's not, when you have, they're here because of oil. Mm-hmm. And we started out with 2.4, 3.6, and now you're hearing we have 20 billion barrels of oil out there. And early on they said it was only recovered at 3%, 7%. And now we're hearing estimates that the technology to take, we could recover 20 or 30% of it. I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of oil at that point. We also have to remember that this is a one-time resource. There could be a time when it's no longer going to be there. So because of that, this is our ability to look to the future, be a little bit visionary. The Legacy Fund is part of that, and develop resources that are going to be good for the state for years to come. To say that they're going to go away, they have that same argument in every oil state. They had it in Wyoming, they had it in Alaska, they had it in Oklahoma, and so on. If we don't lower our taxes, we're going to leave. I'll agree, there's other shale plays in the nation. They could go to those, but nowhere that I know that has a 99% success rate. The amount of barrels that is the capability of producing that, and when the short time period, and we're talking 60, 90 days, that early production on pays off the rig price and the fracking, they're doing it such a short period of time. Even when they did the old vertical wells and they're 1/10 the price, it would take 6 to 12 months to pay that drilling cost off. When you now can do it in 60 days, 90 days, I question to differ.
In the few minutes we have left, I wanted to get in a little bit into property taxes, because you mentioned that as one of the Democrats' top priority this year. The bill is somewhere about the education funding formula, which would lower property taxes directly, but there's some talk about some other ways to do property taxes. One bill that was defeated was a proposal to say if you're under the age of 65, the first $75,000 of your home is exempt, and if you're over 65, the first $125,000 of your home is exempt. Where do you see that starting to shake out?
Well, one, I think, you know, we started something with we wanted some tax relief. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not really tax reform, the education bill, so on, but we had that idea years ago, Democratic Valley, let's put some more money in education to help lower that property tax down. We said put more money in the cities, put more money in the counties, because if we don't fund it at the state level to a little higher priority, what's their last recourse? Well, we have to raise property tax. It goes on the local entities. And there's a lot of services that people expect. And one is education. You know, we're constitutionally required to fund 70% of education. So let's fund it at that level. So we have to put that in. And so we look at that portion. If we're going to increase the funding, that's our opportunity to put a requirement, maybe lower some of those mills down for that. Is that a long-term fix? No. You're seeing now that there's a process to kind of wean us from that portion of that, still keep the funding levels at that point, tie it to fuel the mills state, and keep that down. Can we go any further? I believe we can. There is a vision there to, oh, we should lower income tax. We should lower the corporate tax. When I'm in the countryside, nobody talks to me about that. They don't say, boy, my income tax is too high. I can talk to a tax accountant. We'll say nobody complains to him about that. In the corporate world, a lot of those things get expounded back. So Measure 2 was here. It was a kind of a bright light shining on there. We better deal with it. And if we don't this session, we have to come back. So they look at it as the school thing does some things, but we don't address the appraisal portion of that. And we look at trying to better our own residents here, not necessarily the out-of-state interest, and that's where the homestead tax credit, taking the first $100,000, $125,000 of your valuation of your home would go away. We do say that you still have to pay at least 20% of that, so you got a little bit of...
skin in the game, basically.
Yep, a little bit of cost in that. But we favor that because it goes right back to North Dakota residents. You know, a number of people, whether we... even the education bill. You know, your out-of-state corporations, your out-of-state residents that own land and property here, they benefit as well. And if there's a comment that comes back to me, says, well, why are we giving it to those out-of-staters? You know, so, you know, I have to somewhat agree, how can we help it for North Dakota? You know, they're here. You know, I mean, they have to live with this, they need the services provided, so... I favor what we can do for our North Dakotans. And so rather than maybe even income tax or corporate tax, there's a dollar value to all those. Let's see if we can't convert this over to more property tax relief and whether it's that first amount of valuation or that goes away, or say, hey, here, first 20%. I mean, we're going to keep that. It somewhat addresses the appraisals that go up. You know, for a lot of communities that got, they look at the education thing, but their community reappraised all their houses. And what we supposedly dropped in their property tax through the educational funding, the appraisals went up, and they'll say, gee, I didn't see any relief. And so you recognize that it's not easy to address it, and there's a lot of implications when you do one thing versus another, but I think some expanding our homestead tax credit would go a long ways to help North Dakota.
Is there the appetite to do that, do you think?
Well, the appetite's there to have some kind of reform. Now, what method you do that with is one thing. They want to see some more relief somewhere, so. Is the appetite there? Right. It is there. How we go about it. You know, some will agree that says, well, we should give it to corporations because corporations are the job creators and so on. Let's give it back to those people that those corporations hire and work in their homes, and let's put it back in their homes and help them have home ownership. The other part of that is through that relief is some renter's credit. You can argue the fact that renters don't pay property tax. The landlords do. When the landlord got the decrease, did it transfer over to the rent? I highly doubt it. So we're looking at some kind of renter's credit that goes along with that homestead tax credit as well.
Okay. I just want to touch this briefly. The Chancellor of Higher Education had a bit of a dust-up with some members of the Senate concerning a building project at UND, the IT building, and the Chancellor's office space there. He appeared before the Appropriations Committee, may have smoothed some feathers there. What does your caucus think about the Chancellor of Higher Education?
Well, right now we're kind of reserving that, see how things play out. We're disappointed that, on one hand, our caucus has always been highly supportive of higher ed. We recognize the value of our residents to go on to college and so on, and all the statistics show that to better everything is good. So we've always been supportive of higher ed. We're disappointed in the fact that these kind of things have come into play, and however you want to look at it, where the truth's at and so on, we're not sure, but it clouds that. And so what it does, it allows other people to say, well, we should go away with higher ed board of higher education because they can't control things and so on. And is that true? I'm not sure. It's just it puts a focus on something else when we should be focused on that. That's really what the higher ed board needs to focus on. And deal with that. Is he the right person? Is he not? They're the ones that have made a choice to hire him. They have they themselves have to deal with it, because we have to fund higher ed, and if people are going to look as they're not doing their job or whatever, that's really too bad, because it puts a light on the whole thing that, you know, we wish it, if it's going to happen some other time, not now when we're trying to dedicate a medical building. You know, we need it. Mm-hmm. We need to expand the law buildings and UND campus, because 70-80% of our lawyers in the state come from UND. We need that.
And I have to stop you right there, because we're out of time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Our guest, the House Minority Leader, Representative Kenton Onstead of Partial North Dakota. For Prairie Public and Legislative Review, I'm Dave Thompson.